Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Well, we're continuing the story of Joseph today. We're going to be looking at Genesis 48 and 49. So I hope you'll turn your Bibles there with me. Genesis 48. Now, it came about after these things that Joseph was told. Now, the rabbis say that Ephraim went and studied with Jacob, and he's the one that told Joseph. Well, that may be, I don't know. Behold, your father is sick, and he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. Now, these would be half Egyptian boys, of course. And notice Manasseh, the oldest boy, is mentioned first. When it was told to Jacob, behold, your son Joseph has come to you, Israel collected his strength and sat up in his bed. Now, apparently the man was really getting older and sick. And so apparently he got himself together and sat up on the bed. He knew he was going to do a very important thing, which is bless these two boys and adopt them. Then Jacob said to Joseph, back to verse 2. And it was told Jacob, behold, Joseph has come, and Israel collected his strength and sat up in bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Cana and blessed me. He's going to do a brief historical rendition about how God has been so gracious in his life. Now, the word God Almighty is the term El Shaddai. El, the general name for God in the ancient Near East, we think it means to be strong, and Shaddai, apparently from a woman's breast, which we think means the all-sufficient one. So God as the strong, all-sufficient one. It's a uniquely patriarchal name. It goes back to usage by Abraham, and so Jacob is following in the line of his fathers here. Now, appeared to me at Luz. This was Bethel, and it's first recorded in Genesis 28, 17 and 19, and later in Genesis 35, 9 through 15 again, in the land of Cana, and blessed me. And he said to me, behold, and there's several things he's going to say here. I will make you a fruitful and numerous, number 2. I will make you a great companies of peoples, and number 3, I will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. And here is the three aspects going back to the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12, 1 through 3. I think there's two very important passages that interpret the rest of the Bible. The first is this call of Abraham in Genesis 12, 1 through 3, and its subsequent issues of this same covenant idea. And then Deuteronomy 27 and 28, which is the cursings and blessings of this covenant relationship. Okay? Now, notice it says then, the land forever, an everlasting possession. This is the Hebrew word olam, and it's one of those words that must be interpreted in light of its context. For you know the exile is going to occur where the land was taken away. This word does not mean in eternity, but it does mean as long as the covenant relationship exists. And as you know, Israel and his descendants broke that, and therefore they were taken out of the land for a period of time. And now your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to Egypt, are mine. Now, what does he mean, they're mine? Well, he's going to adopt them. They're going to be full-fledged heirs. Notice it says, Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine as Reuben and Simeon. Now, Reuben and Simeon are the firstborn and secondborn of Jacob by his wife Leah. Now, of course, here we have the idea. Notice that Ephraim comes before Manasseh. We're going to see in this account that Jacob, in his wisdom, knows that Ephraim will be the more stronger of the two and blesses him first. And so here we have that idea here. What's really going to happen is that Ephraim is going to take the place of Reuben in this. Well, Joseph is going to take the place of Reuben and get that double inheritance. And he's going to split that double inheritance between his two sons. You might want to see 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1, when this very same thing is stated. But your offspring that you have born after them. Now, to tell you the truth, he's talking about Joseph having more children, but we know nothing about Joseph having more children. Maybe he did. But if he did, verse 6 tells us, they'll simply be considered the heirs of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now look at verse 7. And as for me, when I came from Paddan Aram, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And this, of course, was his favorite wife. She died in the child bearing of Benjamin. And that's this account right here. She was buried right along the roadside, apparently because later on she'll fulfill the prophecy where it says Rachel weeping for her children. as Ephraim and Manasseh, part of the 10 tribes, were taken into captivity by the very road where she was buried. So it became a future allusion to the rabbis. Verse 8, when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" Now, there's two possibilities here. We know from verse 10 that his eyes were very bad. He could almost be considered blind, but apparently had some eyesight. And Joseph had not mentioned. Now, either that he couldn't see well, or maybe he hadn't seen the boys in a while, and you know how rapidly children grow. There's been much speculation about how old these boys were. It seems they're very young here, but they should have been close to 20, if our recollections are right. And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons whom God has given me." Notice that, Joseph always recognized the source of all his blessings. I got tickled in reading the rabbis. They said that Joseph had to show Jacob his marriage license because that proved that his wife had converted to Judaism. A bit much. I'm sure he witnessed to her, and I'm sure she did take on his faith, but this verse doesn't reflect that. "And bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now, this is a very important. This patriarchal blessing here of Ephraim and Manasseh is going to be seen in its theological sense in the next chapter where all the tribes are blessed. And so here it's kind of a precursor, but shows the significance of this patriarchal blessing as Jacob himself has had experienced as he stole the blessing from his brother Esau. I think in divine prophecy fulfillment, but still with some very poor circumstances. Now the eyes of Israel were dim from age. That's verse 10. So he could not see. Then Joseph brought them close to him. He kissed them and embraced them. I think something of the affection of this father for those sons of Rachel can be seen in these grandkids here. And they let that older man do that, of course. And Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your grandchildren as well." It's a real sign of blessing. Verse 12, then Joseph took them from his knees. Now, it is my personal opinion, and I realize there's some very good godly commentators who think I'm just nuts at this point, particularly Loophole, but I think the two boys, apparently Jacob had spread his legs apart and let those two boys come real close in between his legs. Now, I think the ancient adoption rite was to pass those boys under his thighs, a symbol of them issuing from his own loins. So I think when Joseph moved them out of the way so he could kneel down with his two boys, one on the right and one on the left. I think it's that ancient adoption practice of passing them under the thigh. Now, notice if you would, where it mentions, he took them from his knees and bowed his face to the ground. There's the daddy and the two sons right before the old patriarch. And Jacob took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right. Now, what was that for? Well, the right hand was a significant blessing. And Joseph thought that Manasseh, being the oldest, should get the greater of the blessing. So he arranged the boys for his father to bless. But notice what happens. But Israel stretched out his hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger. Now, he must have crossed his hands over, but for a very important purpose. And his left hand was on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands. Now, the rabbis say he braided his hands, but I think crossed over fits the text much better. Although Manasseh was the firstborn. And here's the blessing. And he blessed Joseph. Does that sound funny that he blessed Joseph when he's supposed to bless these two boys? Well, of course, these two boys were really receiving the blessing of Joseph. And so I think it fits the context beautifully. The God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked. There's number one description of God. Number two, the God whom has been my shepherd all my life to this day. There's description number two. Reminds you of Psalm 23, doesn't it? Here's description number three of God. The angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Now, this is obviously in a tripartite blessing. This is obviously angel representing deity. That's why many of us believe this is the angel of the Lord. We have encountered him earlier in Genesis 16:11, Genesis 18:1 and following, Genesis 22:11, as he is an obvious corporal manifestation of Yahweh. And I think it's the pre-incarnate Jesus, but you'll have to decide. Now, notice it says the word, the angel who has redeemed me. This is the word goel. It means that a near kinsman buys a relative back from slavery or from, as a prisoner of war or from economic need. This beautiful concept of Goel, the kinsman redeemer, forms some of the basis for the work of the Messiah. We can see this aspect of Goel, of course, in Ruth, the book of Ruth, in Isaiah chapters 40 through 55, Isaiah 59:20, and in Job chapter 19, verse 25, where this word is used in the sense of a kinsman redeemer, who was also the kinsman avenger, by the way. So here he's saying, God has protected me. The God of my fathers has been with me, has kept me, has protected me, has walked with me, has redeemed me from evil, and he's been with me. And the names of my fathers, Abraham, and he blessed the lads, and may my name live on in them. Now, it's obvious here that this is the sense of his, they're going to be part of his true inheritance. Some say it's connected to the ancient idea that somehow in our posterity, our afterlife is continued. Now, there is some evidence of that, that the people of Israel believe that they lived on their children in some significant way. But I don't think that's the background here. I really think it's the inheritance rights that are being emphasized. Now, another possibility here is that Jacob's name, Jacob's faith, the character of Jacob's love for God is going to be kept on in these kids. And I think there's some real truth there. May they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, of course, it's the word land. If you look at a chart, Ephraim and Manasseh were right in the middle of the promised land, and maybe that's it. When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. Now, really, the literal is, it was evil in his eyes. But I think that's pretty too strong of a translation. Jacob was doing to these children what God had apparently told his mother to do for him. Now, why is that? Well, I think that God is trying to say over and over throughout Genesis, it's my choice, not your choice. It's my ways, not your ways. It's my resources, not your resources. And this is one more example of it. Whether it's Abraham being promised a child with a barren wife or whatever, God said, it's my choice. Quite often he goes to another than the firstborn. He'll do it for Judah in the line of the Messiah. He'll do it for Joseph in the line of the inheritance. Now, notice it would that he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But the father refused and said, "No, my son, I know. And he shall become a people, and he shall be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he." Now, the rabbis say that it's because Joshua is going to come from Ephraim that Ephraim is greater than Manasseh. Now, Manasseh is going to receive larger land inheritance than Ephraim. Ephraim is just north of Benjamin, or just north of Judah. They became a very powerful people. They were the other rival tribes. When the kingdom split, the leaders from Ephraim were the first kings. Now, notice if you would in verse 20. "And he blessed them that day, saying, But you, Israel, shall pronounce blessing, saying, May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." So it's going to become a proverb in Israel, the blessings on Ephraim and Manasseh, and it's going to be recognized their source from God. Verse 21, "Then Israel said to Joseph, Behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers." This seems to be a direct reference to the idea that they're not going to stay in Egypt. There's going to be the Exodus. It was alluded to back in Genesis 15, 12 through 16, and Jacob apparently knows that and makes reference to it. Now, verse 22 has really caused a lot of trouble. "And I gave you one portion more than your brothers." Now, the word portion here is literally the word shoulder. And it's translated by the city's name, Shechem. Now, some think it refers to the fact that he's a head and a shoulders taller than his brothers are going to inherit more. Or it refers to the territory that he's going to inherit in which Shechem is located. Others say no, it refers to the city itself. But there's no real sign of that. Some say it's going to refer to the place where Joseph is going to be buried, which is Shechem, and that would be Joshua 24:32. But that seems rather a far-fetched allusion here. I think it's just the idea of an extra blessing for the firstborn. And of course, Ephraim will take the place of Reuben, which I took from the hand of the Amorites. Now, Amorites, a collective term for all the peoples of Canaan. Sometimes the word Canaanites a collective term. But in Genesis 15:16, the collective term is Amorite, which I took from the hand of the Amorite by my sword and my bow. Now, we know nothing about this. as far as Jacob having a military conquest. I doubt very seriously if he's using the ideal of Simeon and Levi killing the men of Shechem as a background for this. But some say it's referred to here. Others say it's just an account we don't have, and I think that's probably best. Now, notice in chapter 49, we come to a blessing. When Isaac was about to die, or at least thought he was in chapter 27, he blessed his sons. When Moses is about to die, he's going to bless the children of Israel. Deuteronomy 33. When Joshua is about to die, he's going to bless. That's Joshua 24. When Samuel's about to die, he's going to bless, 1 Samuel 12. So it's not unusual here that Israel does this. Now, the order of these boys seems to be Leah's first and then Rachel's last. That's the way to do emphasis, that who comes first and that who comes last, last receiving the most. Now, notice also that there's a real word play through here on all these boys' names, and the characteristic seen in the father is seen somehow in the tribe. These word plays are first seen back in Genesis 29:30 through Genesis 30:24. Now, this chapter is somewhat hard to deal with because the references are in poetic form. Sometimes the allusion is not certain. Sometimes the Hebrew is ambiguous. But the general thrust can be known, if not all the details, all right? And notice it says what's going to happen in the days to come. Now, some say, does that mean the immediately preceding days? Does that mean the future days of Israel history? Does that mean the Messianic period, or primarily the Davidic period, or primarily the conquest period? We can't answer that. Knowing how prophecy is written, the answer is probably yes. It refers to all of them in some sense. Now, the implication through all this chapter is that God is the controller both of the history of nations and of individuals. It's like Psalms 139. He made us exactly like we are for His own purpose. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, my firstborn. Now, of course, it's very important that we recognize the firstborn had preeminence. That's what it says here. My might, the beginning of my strength. Now, Vulgate has sorrow because of what's going to follow, but I think the Hebrew word should be strength. Preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. And look at verse 4. What a fall from verse 3. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. So verse 3 shows what should have been. Verse 4 shows what is. This word uncontrolled is either used in the sense of passion, and that's what the context backs up, or the sense of greed and impatience at wanting to inherit what his father had, i.e. his father, one of his father's concubines, Bilhah. Now, notice it says, because you went on your father's bed and you defiled it, he went up to his father's couch. The switch from the third to the first shows with a horror which Jacob thought what his son did. You might want to see Genesis 25:32. Now, verse 5, Simeon and Levi, and they're always linked together. Matter of fact, the word Levi means joined. And many think there's a pun down in verse 6 where it says united with their assembly. They were a pair, like Zebulun and Ishkar are going to be a pair. They were always together, possibly the same kind of age and play together. Their swords are implements of violence. But I think the word swords probably should better be tools. The Hebrew's uncertain here, but the word swords comes from a Greek word that's similar sounding to the Hebrew word. And I'm not sure Jacob knew Greek, so I think that's a bit much. Tools. Some say they snuck into Shechem by having farming tools, not swords, and then used those farming tools to kill everybody. Let my soul not enter into their council, and let my glory not be united with their assembly. In other words, my soul and my glory are in a parallel relationship. Now, the Septuagint has the word liver, the word glory, but of course that is another way of referring to the person's selfhood. I think in the Psalms, we see these two terms linked so often, we know they're synonyms. Psalm 7, verse 6, Psalm 16, verse 9, Psalm 30, verse 13. Because in anger they slew men. Obviously a reference to these circumcised men of Shechem who treated their sister Diana in a very shameful way, but tried to make up for it and marry the girl, but they killed them. Genesis 34, 25 through 30. Now, other sons were involved in that, but apparently these two were the ringleaders and planners. We have something else here, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. We know nothing about them laming oxen, but that's probably true. They just cut the back leg of the ligament of the ham so the animals were crippled and unusable, just for meanness' sake. And that's the idea here. Some say this word oxen is a metaphor for the leading men of the city. And that would fit the context because it was the king's son who were involved in this. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce. Always reminds you of the sons of thunder, doesn't it? James and John. And their wrath, for it is cruel. I will dispose them in Jacob. Now we know that Simeon, finally, because of its tribal allocation, had a hard time in that southern desert region. And their numbers dwindled very fast, and they were incorporated into Judah. Levi will be incorporated into the whole nation as priest. The 48 Levitical cities are their only inheritance. One reason I think Genesis 48 is ancient is because there's no positive mention of Levi, as there will be in Deuteronomy 33 in Joseph. So here, there's going to be two dispersions. Simeon's going to be dispersed into Judah. Levi's going to be dispersed into all Israel as priests, take the place of the firstborn. Now notice, if you would, where it mentions them, in Judah, in verse 8. Now it's obvious that Judah is going to have the line of the Messiah. The blessings are tremendous for Judah and tremendous for Joseph. It's kind of like we split up the inheritance rights and the line of the Messiah in these two different sons. Now, Judah is a play on the word praise, and you see it there in the first line of verse 8. You might go back to Genesis 29:35 for that. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies, meaning they'll be very victorious in military victories, meaning as soon as it refers to David or the Messiah. Your father's sons will bow down to you. This is the idea that they're going to be the kings of Israel are going to come out of Judah. And Judah is a lion's whelp. Now, whelp is not a good translation. This is a young lion in the full vigor of its youth. The most dangerous, agile lion is what it's referring to. And, of course, the Messiah is going to be called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. It's one of the many metaphors used for this. From the prey, my son, have gone up. He couches and lies down as a lion. Who dares to rouse him? Metaphor of majesty and strength and power. Now, verse 10 has been a wonderful verse, but greatly disputed as far as what exactly it means. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Now, the scepter and the ruler's staff are synonymous. It was maybe either a shepherd's staff, like Pharaoh had, a short one, or maybe a war club or some kind of a diadem. But it was long enough that apparently these kings, we have pictures in the walls of some of these, of both Egypt and Mesopotamia, would put that staff between their feet to hold it as they sit on the throne. And that's the idea here, meaning that the rulers are going to come from Judah. Now, look at the next line, though. It's what killed everybody. Until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of peoples. Well, who is Shiloh? Well, number one, it's a place name in the northern tribes. But it's not a real important place. There's no messianic events happen there. Nothing significant happens in the life of Judah there. So some say, well, it's not so much a place name, but it's a shorthand for until what is his comes, meaning until Judah's full due or full inheritance comes, which is what how the Septuagint translated. There's another possibility that Shiloh is from the same Hebrew consonants that means rest, until rest comes, meaning his reign is secure. But I think the best possibility comes from the same phrase being used in the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 21, verse 26 and 27, which seems to be a quote from this passage, where it means his rightful heir. The divinic king, the Messiah, is how the Revised Standard Version translates it, and I think the Revised Standard's best. Some say it comes from Babylonian root, mean prince. Well, that would solve all our problems. We just can't be certain. I think the RSV has the best translation, and it's obviously messianic. As Judah is going to rule the tribes, this one coming out of Shiloh, until it comes to him it belongs, is going to rule all the peoples, i.e. all the world. The Targums translate this, until the Messiah comes to whom the kingdom is due. I agree with that. Now, notice it mentions here that he's going to tie his foal to a vine, his donkey to a choice vine. These donkeys might eat the choice vine or pull it or tear it apart, but there's going to be so many vines, it doesn't make any difference. So it's a metaphor of prosperity. The same is true about his eyes are dull from wine, his teeth white from milk. It's just a metaphor of prosperity, how much wine they're going to have, how much milk they're going to have. Then Zebulun's going to live by the seashore. It's not quite, but it's close. Zebulun and Ishkar are together. Zebulun is going to be known for its trade. Ishkar is going to be a strong, like a day laborer. That's one of the translations of donkey here. But they're going to be kind of lazy, seems to be the implication, but we're not sure because the Hebrew is ambiguous here. Now, Dan, word for Dan, the word for judge, of the same root. Diana is a feminine form of that. And tradition says they were judges. Some say They're the first tribe to have idolatry, Judges 18. And because that they're left out in the list of tribes in Revelation 7, 5 through 8, it's been kind of through history, especially the early church fathers, that the Antichrist would come from Dan. That's Irenaeus, Ambrose, Augustine, and Theodore, but we're not sure. Let's see. Loophole, one of my favorite commentators on Genesis, says that both this aspect of Dan being a horned snake and the aspect down here of Benjamin being a ravenous wolf are positive, not negative. And I think we've got to see that true in the light of this. Now, Gad is a play on the word for raiders or troops. And you can see it three times there. He's going to be raided. He lives in an area where a lot of raids will happen, but he'll pursue those who raid them and be victorious over them. Let's see. Asher is going to be known for its very good food. The king's going to get food from there. Naphtali is the idea of either an animal let loose to run around, maybe a swift-footed soldier. We're not sure. There are many different translation differences. You need to look at that. Now, Joseph is thought of as a fruit bough next to a well. His branches run everywhere. Notice different names for God used in verse 24. The mighty one of Jacob, the shepherd, the stone of Israel, the God of your father, the Almighty. Beautiful, beautiful names for God. Primarily God as victor. And that's what the first name means. You might well see Isaiah 1:24, Isaiah 49:26, Isaiah 60:16. For this military victor is what God is pictured here as. Notice verse 25 is basically the idea or the metaphor of abundant water. Water from above, water from below, as well as fruit of the womb, both men and cattle. Now, the everlasting hills here is the translation of the Septuagint and the Revised Standard Version, seeming to go back to Deuteronomy 33:15, but they do change one vowel to get that. The Hebrew has, my progenitors unto. And that may be another metaphor for the allusion to all of these children they're going to have, and that may be it. Now, Benjamin's a ravenous wolf. You ought to see Benjamin talked about in Judges 19 through 21. He really was tough. Now, then that's about it, and he tells about where to bury them and how. Mentions this cave of Machpelah, then in verse 29. You ought to see Genesis 23, 1 through 19. Mentions about Leah and Rachel's burials, the first time we've seen that. Then in verse 33, it says, he drew his feet back into his bed and breathed his last. If he was sitting on the side of the bed, it just meant he put his feet up. Or it may be he got in the fetal position. We're just not sure. Now, breathed his last means the word for spirit and breath are related, so it just means he died. And that's the ideal here. And so there's the end of this. Notice he's not afraid to die. He dies with great peace after he did what he wanted to, and that's bless his boys, warn them about their natural tendencies, and project the tribes and some kind of characteristics into the future. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place next week. May the Lord bless you.